Welcome to Ain't Slayed Nobody. This is an actual play podcast intended for adults and may contain material that some people find disturbing. Please see the episode notes for content warnings and listen with care.
And so we will move on to the dusk. Now, the dusk phase it's a short phase. It's meant to set up our night phase, basically. It's a preparation for the night. The assumption is that in the dusk, or right before evening, or before nighttime, the four of you get together at Hargrave House and confer. You share all the things you've learned. Maybe you even talk a little bit about what you're going to do from this point forward, etc. But we don't role play that. We just assume that you've shared all relevant information and all the stuff is, you know. Now, if there's something you want to keep back, you can do that. But clues are assumed to be shared always. So we use the dusk phase to kind of memorialize this planning time, essentially. Or the first thing we have to do is to resolve any playbook moves that are resolved during the dusk phase. And I see that we have two. We have the quickening for the American and Moonlight Upon the Waves for the Selkie. The darkness is far safer for London's animal life, and you are no exception. During the dusk phase, you can invoke Moonlight Upon the Waves. At the start of the night phase, you put on your pelt and take to London's waters in the form of a seal. While transformed, you can speak with the watery creatures lurking in the city's rivers and canals, and you can take actions reasonable of a very intelligent and crafty seal. Choose two boons and one complication from the list below. During the dawn phase that follows, you're forced to return to your human form. So, do you want to become a seal?
I mean, sure, why not? Because don't we want to see what happens?
Yeah.
I want to see what happens.
Yeah. When would the answer ever be no?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how seals could help with a haunted house, but I really want to see.
You know, you gotta test it out.
So go ahead and tick that box that says you're invoking Moonlight Upon the Waves.
Okay.
You're going to get two boons and one complication. Be thinking about what you want those to be.
Okay.
There's lists there for people listening, wondering what I'm talking about. Now let's go to the quickening. On the quickening, you must roll with composure or sensitivity, Mr. Kessler. I'll read the move here. Mm-hmm. You live with a curse that causes you to become savage, even feral, to the point where your body physically changes. At the start of the dusk phase, roll with composure or sensitivity, your choice.
I'm going to roll with composure.
And I'm going to take a look at your conditions. I think Icy Grasp would make it harder for you to keep control, so roll with disadvantage as well.
Okay. Oh boy.
So 3d6, take the two lowest.
Yes. Oh, God, the first one's a one. Oh, no!
Oh, man!
I rolled a three total.
A three. Let's take a look at the move. It says...
Oh, boy.
On a miss, you're going to lose control. Oh. You have two options. The first option is retire this character and tell the keeper to put the cursed in play. Or...
Hmm.
Oh my God.
I'll take the other one.
Reveal your curse to another hunter and ask for their help controlling you this night.
Oh.
If they agree, neither of you can take any action that would trigger a move during the upcoming night phase, though you should narrate scenes showing how the cursed character is being controlled through the night. During the dawn phase, you each mark one XP. You only get to do this once.
Lord,
you can also invoke the Janus Mask, too, to bump it up to a seven.
I think it's fun to reveal it up front and go ahead and use it. So, And I know that Ms. Archer has experience with beasts, so I will hope that she, in good faith, will keep control of me, but not kill me.
Ms. Archer, are you okay with giving up your night phase to keep Mr. Kessler under control?
Yeah. Let's do this. Teamwork.
When Roland asked Archer to help, I think he just walked out with the manacles and they kind of like drape down and he says,
"We need to talk."
Mr. Kessler.
I love it. The next thing we do for the dusk phase is we paint the scene about Hargrave House itself. So one of the things we want to always do is be mindful of the fact that these hunters live in this big, enormous Gothic mansion and what that place is like and its history. And so I'm going to pick a room that presumably your characters have met in this evening to chat about what they've learned. And that will determine which paint the scene we do. We'll keep it simple and start with the salon. What do we see in this room that makes it the most comfortable spot in the house?
Well, if I'm going to speak personally, there's like a giant beanbag chair that like envelops you when you go into it. And it's the closest thing I can find to the hug of the waves.
Victorian beanbag.
Yeah, Victorian beanbag. You know what? We created it if we needed
it. Patent pending. There's a giant fireplace.
There is a trolley with a large selection of fine liquors, including some rather nice brandy.
Maybe this is the one room in the house where the dog kind of hangs out.
There's a dog?
We sit in here and pet the dog.
Love it.
Maybe it's a beagle.
Oh, so I'm sure your neighbors are really happy about that.
That's why it's only allowed in the salon. It's the interior.
This was back before the lines became neurotic.
Fantastic. I love it. Probably they're wondering why you don't take that dog out hunting, why you just let it roam around the house. Should be out hunting rabbits. So you're all hanging out in the salon. We're seeing all this comfort. I would normally ask if you want to answer a question at this point. If we take a look at the clues that you've gathered, you have gathered 5 clues, which you could maybe have a go at the question, which part of the house is the ghost attached to? But if you don't want to do that yet, we can skip this. Does anybody want to say definitively which part of the house the ghost is attached to?
How specific does the answer have to be?
It doesn't have to be super specific. It can be more like related to an idea rather than a location.
The only thing is the clue has to connect to the answer. So even the clue like the love letters would have to contribute.
And you can add whatever context would help. So like if we could say that the love letters always mention this one bedroom or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you use clues and how does it help towards what you're doing?
I'll read the move out. It's called Answer a Question. When the hunters have an open, freewheeling discussion about the answer to a question, once they've gathered a number of clues equal to at least half the complexity and reach a consensus, you roll plus the number of clues incorporated into the answer or otherwise explained away minus the complexity. So basically, for this first question, you start at -2, and then every clue you work in bumps it up 1.
So we probably shouldn't use them all, right?
Probably not.
I wouldn't, no. You do have to answer that other one to actually resolve the threat.
Maybe 2 or 3.
Yeah, I feel like the burning room.
Yeah, the flaming room feels like it.
Really important, yeah.
Yeah. The flaming room, and that was upstairs, right?
It was. It was on the 3rd floor.
And with the hands around the throat, right, you kind of had the proximity of maybe that side of the house, the same side as the burning room.
Yeah.
We could say that. We can say that, like, whenever you were underneath that window, you felt it most tightly.
And so that would negate the -2, right? So just be a straight roll at this point? Should we save our other clues?
Might be worth using one more.
The only reason I'm reluctant to use the love letters is because I feel like it's so flexible for the other one.
Yes, right?
Could we say, though, that, like, when I was walking through the house, I felt a chill when I got near the stairwell for the third floor.
Oh, sure. Oh, I like that. That's pretty good. Yeah. Maybe Ms. Beale, on your way out, gave you just a quick tour and you felt the temperature drop by that room.
Yeah.
Between Constance Head's vision, the tightening of the throat, and the dropping of the temperature in that this particular room. Does anybody want to just say what the room is? That might be great. Like, what is the function of the room?
Yeah, a bedroom.
Yeah.
So it's probably a bedroom, yeah.
And if it's third floor, could it be like the bedroom of, like, it would, that's where most likely like a child of the family who lived there would be?
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, the nursery. Yeah.
The nursery is actually a specific place in the house, which is in the very, very top attic space.
Do a child's room, though.
Yeah, it could be Roger's room. Roger Beale is the boy, not the baby. Okay, so Roger Beale's room.
Mm-hmm.
You have a +1 because you've worked in 3 clues. It's a good theory. Who wants to roll 2d6 +1?
Not me.
What do I have to roll?
You need a 7.
Okay, we got a 5.
Okay, so that's a miss, which means you're wrong.
Yep.
I knew it was the nursery.
Your clues are not spent. Your clues are still available to use, but I will do a hard reaction because of your miss. That hard reaction is going to be this. A little bit of the ghost came home with one of you, and no one is getting to leave Hargrave House tonight.
Oh.
And also, Mr. Kessler's wolfing out, so...
Yeah, it's kind of okay for us that we don't leave.
Yeah.
That worked out.
So it's going to change the nature of your night phase. Now, you all can bump it up. If you all mark the Janus Mask, you can bump it up. But that's a big, big... Everybody has to do a Janus Mask.
I think if it was the bigger tier question, maybe, but not for this one. Right?
Does that mean I'm not going into the waters either?
No.
During dusk? Okay.
Oh, that's sad. You can stay home and name the beagle.
I really wanted to go swimming, guys. Oh,
well. You can go tomorrow night.
We're now stuck at home with both a ghost and a werewolf.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, yeah. Or whatever Mr. Kessler changes into, yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's also a ghost here.
It's just an average Thursday night at Hargrave House.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, so you didn't spend your clues, but you do have that question still available to be answered. Let's keep going here. Well, you each say what you're going to be doing during the night phase, but I wouldn't even bother because I've got it under control what you're going to be doing during the night phase. And so, do we have any Janus Mask prompts that remain unresolved at this point? I don't think we do, but in that case, let's talk about the unseen. Now, the unseen is a special thing. It's very, very different to anything you'll have seen in another role-playing game. And the idea is, during this night phase, this night that you're all doing what you're doing, there's something else going on the same night in another part of London. And we're going to take a look at that too. Because one of our goals in this game is to talk about London sort of as its own character. And this is one of the ways we explore London as a character. Now, the events of the unseen have no direct connection to Hargrave House or St. James's Street or this story at all. It is completely separate. There's no connection, except there can be thematic connections between the unseen and your hunter scenes. We call those connections echoes in the night. Now, you might have seen on your dawn questions, there's a question that says, did you get an echo in the night? And what that means is, did you narrate something either in the unseen or in the hunter scene that reflected the other? So, for example, this is what an echo in the night is. Let's say that Scott is describing, during the unseen, describing a sex worker dying of consumption. And Scott describes this sex worker coughing blood into a bowl. And then later, Cup describes a bowl of beautiful red flowers. That would be an echo in the night, because it's a sort of visual connection between the unseen and the hunter scene. Or it could be more direct. Maybe in the unseen, someone describes like a scene of poverty. And then in the hunter scene, you describe a similar scene of like destitution or something, right? It can be thematic. It can be visual. It can be any kind of sensory sort of connection. But the idea is the only real connection between the unseen and the hunter scenes is just this thematic or sensory or motif connection, right? The night phase is very short. We'll probably wrap it in like 20 minutes. It's really, really short. And the unseen is sort of the timer of it because we bounce between unseen, hunter scene, unseen, hunter scene. And there's four unseen prompts. And once they're all gone, that's the end of the night phase. And so it's really fast. It's really feral. It's really quick. And it's all kind of guided by the unseen. And once the unseen's over, the hunter scene's almost over too. Our unseen for tonight is going to be the prison hulk at Woolwich. Moored near the industrial town of Woolwich are a number of hollowed out old warships that serve as temporary prisons for convicts set to be transferred to Australia and other penal colonies. One of these prison hulks is HMS Bellerophon, now called Captivity. A too young cook is walking above and below deck, passing out the evening's portion of hard biscuits and pea soup. Paint the scene. How do we know the captivity is a nightmare of filth and desperation?
Any place where restraints are attached to the wall, there are what look like fingernail scratches around the attachment, and there's probably some dried blood around it too, suggesting that people have tried desperately to try to like remove their restraints.
There's the constant backdrop sound, almost like a hum of like wailing and crying in the background of everything on this ship.
Rats. So many rats.
Yeah, I was going to go with rats, too.
More rats.
Even more.
Let's go with the smell. So it just smells like human waste. And unless you were chained up, it wouldn't be tolerable.
Moira, you are perhaps getting ready to go out to hopefully not swim in the Thames, but maybe, I don't know, but getting ready to go into the waterways. As you are getting ready to head out for the evening, you are stopped. If you look out from the front door of Hargrave House, it looks out into the square. And on either side of the square are other homes, and then Hargrave House is on the side that you're on. And normally the square is filled with hansom cabs picking up people to go to various posh events around the city. Servants and delivery boys, you know, doing things, you know, in the front, maybe gardeners wrapping up for the day, whatever. But tonight, you just see the glow of gas lamps and the empty, wet cobblestones of the square. And you see a woman pushing a perambulator, a baby carriage, into the middle of the square. Now, you won't recognize the woman, Moira, but Ms. Archer and Mr. Kessler would recognize the woman as Irma Thicket, the cook from 18 St. James's Street. She's pushing the baby carriage, and then she lets go of the handle. And the baby carriage just keeps rolling towards the front door of Hargrave House. I would like the night move. What are you afraid is going to happen if you don't keep your composure right now?
That I'll accidentally like push it away instinctively and like knock it over.
It's worse than that. You won't like what's inside. Go ahead and roll with composure and because of chilled to the bone, I'm going to put you at disadvantage. So you're going to roll 3d6 and take the two lowest.
You're a monster.
Okay. It's three.
We'll come back to this in a moment.
Amazing.
Sebastian Melmoth. How do we see you at the beginning of the evening? What are you doing in your abode right now?
Sebastian has a chaise longue in his room, because of course he does, upholstered in purple velvet. He's wearing a silk dressing gown and lying on it, just reading these love letters one by one. Every time he finishes one, he just tosses it over his shoulder and moves on to the next one. A few of them have obviously still got blood spatters on them, but you know, he reads around those as best he can.
Fantastic. Mr. Kessler, how do you know that the quickening, that the curse has found you in London?
I think it starts with when he was relaxing in the salon, just kind of cracking his knuckles. And when he did that, it cracked a little too hard. And he recognized that that's what happens when his bones start to transform.
Ms. Archer, you had an omen, a premonition, a feeling, a sense that there is something monstrous either in this house or approaching this house. What is it?
They're all sitting in the salon, and there's this kind of like prickle on the back of her neck that feels like it's kind of a hunter's spidey sense in a way. She knows that it is something supernatural. She knows that it's something with an intent to hurt either her or the people in the house. And she knows that the only way to subdue it is going to be through violence.
Interesting indeed. Let's go back to the captivity. Scott, please narrate a scene in which we see the convicts at leisure. How do they entertain themselves? How do they maintain their connection to God and society, if at all?
We're in the canteen of the prison ship, which isn't really much of a canteen. It's, I guess, a mess hall with tables that have been bolted down. And it's just really where they serve the slops that the prisoners eat. This isn't a mealtime, however. This is later on, and there is a small group of prisoners who have gathered there. The majority of them look pretty unhappy about the whole thing, or at least impatient and confused. There is one, however, who is much more animated. He's a small, bookish man. He looks quite out of place. There's something, perhaps, the teacher about him. He certainly doesn't quite fit in from a class point of view. And he's looking around at all these men, saying, No, let's try this again. Two households, both alike in dignity. Almost immediately, there's rumblings from the men, and a larger man stands up and says, I thought you told us there was going to be a fucking fight scene in this. Before the bookish man gets a chance to really explain what's going on, the first punch flies, and everything descends into bloody chaos.
Ms. Innes, the perambulator is slowly rolling towards you. There's a voice coming from the baby carriage. Maybe it's the baby. It says, I'm just a little baby. I'm just a little baby. Don't you want to come look at me? Don't you want to keep me safe? I'm so helpless in the world. I'm just a little baby.
Of course. Of course I want to help. I will go over. I don't think I've spent a lot of time around human babies.
Indeed. When you look inside the perambulator, you see that it is in fact the evening's roast, wrapped up in a blanket, covered in maggots. because you got a miss on your roll, I'm going to take over and say that you lash out and knock it over, and it spills out. It breaks apart, sending maggots crawling all over the cobbles.
Gods, what is this?
How does this make you feel?
I think just more confused. Moira is confused and doesn't understand. I she didn't know who was pushing the cart either.
Well, it was being pushed by a woman who, Sebastian, is presently floating outside your window.
Oh!
She is suspended in midair, Miss Thicket. Her head is lolled back, her arms are spread wide, Christ-like, and she is floating in the air. This would be a good 15, 20 feet in the air. Her mouth is open, her eyes are rolling around, and she's just making sounds. Sebastian, what do you do?
I stand there at the window, slowly finishing the Turkish cigarette I've been smoking, and then I'll just extinguish it and open up the window and say, if you want to come in, please do so, but just stop making that dreadful racket.
Her head snaps forward, and she smiles, and she says, I thought you'd never ask. And she flies at you, grasping for your throat. This is going to be the night move, but we'll come back in a moment. Mr. Kessler, you're not aware of any of that. You have your own problems. What do you do right now? You are going to lose control. You know what's going to happen.
He's trying to almost drag Ms. Archer by the arm down to the cellar so that she can chain him up. Like, come on. We got to hurry.
Mr. Kessler, please, if you could just tell me, I have spent the dullest afternoon with the most bizarre woman, and I would like to retire. And also...
We don't have time. We have to hurry. He's still dragging. You said you know monsters, right? You.
Of course, yes, I know monsters. Can you tell me anything?
I'm turning into a wolf.
A what?
A wolf. God damn it. Already?
A wolf?
A lycanthrope.
Ah.
I think there's no time to chat. Ms. Archer, how is Mad Dog's body changing before your very eyes? What's happening right now?
I think I can kind of see the elongation, especially, you know, if he's dragging me, the place where he's holding me, I can kind of see the bones on his hand start to elongate and do that weird, like, cracking thing. Ah, I see. Well... off to the basement, and I'll start pushing him in front of me. And does the basement have restraints?
Well, he brought the manacles, so you could, yeah, you can bind him to anything down there, I think.
Excellent. I think she's pushing you through. She kind of like maybe wraps the chain around a post, and you know she'll fix them. She'll like lock them up. And as she's doing that, and under what circumstances can I end your life?
That's a great cut. Back at Woolwich at the captivity, Nick, please narrate a scene in which we see a convict being punished by a ship's officer. What did the convict do? How is the punishment being carried out?
If there's like a pillar or a mast or something, there's a person that is tied to it such that their arms are kind of encircling the mast, and then they're bound up with rope, and they are being... lashed with a whip. This is a fairly, I think, common way that these prisoners are disciplined. And at one point, the whip gets put down, the jacket comes off, the whip gets picked up again, and the whipping continues. Then at another point, the whip just goes down, and now the officer goes over, undoes the restraints of this man, and is just, like, beating him, punching him. And there's a look of intense concentration. If you look close enough at his eyes, there's also something like delight. And the convict did nothing. Didn't do anything in particular. Just maybe looked at the officer in a kind of off-putting way.
Ms. Innes, before we move on from this roast, I'm going to give you a condition. In quotes, I'm just a baby.
Oh my God. I hate it. I'm just a baby.
And then you see Ms. Thicket flying overhead into Mr. Melmoth's window. What do you do?
I will go running upstairs and just go to try and help in some way.
Mr. Melmoth, I want the night move. What do you afraid is going to happen if Ms. Thicket gets the best of you here?
I'm afraid my beautiful amber eyes will turn dead white.
It's worse than that. She will then lie in wait, waiting for anyone who responds, Ms. Ennis. Go ahead and roll with what you described what you're scared of is more of a sensitivity roll.
Oh, dear. Of course it is.
And because you're most beloved, I'm putting you at disadvantage as well. Because she really wants your life force. She really wants what you got.
Okay. That's a six.
A six. Ms. Innes, you come crashing into Mr. Melmoth's, frankly, somewhat palatial rooms. And you just see, well, you smell the onion and tobacco of Miss Thicket, first of all, with just a slight undercurrent of death overpowering those smells and the fragrant smells of Mr. Melmoth's chambers. And you see Miss Thicket, her mouth clamped over Mr. Melmoth's mouth, her tongue working wildly, drawing out his life force.
No, 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 no. No.
And we see Mr. Melmoth's eyes going white, his beautiful face collapsing in on itself. I'll give you one chance to save Mr. Melmoth.
Oh, man.
Unless Scott wants to put on the Janus mask, but I will give you a chance to save him. It's up to the two of you, however you want to play it.
Maybe I know of a tale that was told in the seas. A song that would lure dead spirits to you. And maybe I pull out my flute, emergency flute.
I want to see that. So if Scott's okay with it, I think we should do that.
Oh, yeah. I'm absolutely delighted.
We'll come back to this in a moment. I want the wolf out scene. What's happening here? Like, give it to me. This is all happening at the same time, kind of, which is really intense, right? Mm-hmm. It could even be the presence of the ghost that caused you to lose control, Mad Dog. Mm.
Yeah.
Also, what's the beagle doing?
Oh. The beagle's howling, I'm sure, up in the salon while this is happening.
The beagle's just having a party. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. But I think Miss Archer's going to hear, like, you know, like wet skin stretching, and you'll see that elongation and eyes turn yellow, hair kind of cropping up everywhere on his body. He's going to be fighting hard against the manacles while he transforms. It's just not like a conscious effort to escape, just like that's what it's like when he transforms. So hopefully you're not standing nearby.
I think she would have been standing like at the edge of the reach that the manacles could get to. But I do think that as soon as she sees the struggle start to take place, she's going to start looking for something with which to try to knock you out.
All right.
Fantastic. Let's take our last trip to captivity. Josephine, please narrate a scene in which we see a convict finding comfort and companionship within the bulkheads of the ship.
We see a captive who is laying back in their bed, and they have a series of letters that they're going through one by one, of letters from someone who is clearly very important to them, as they're getting somewhat emotional, and a guard comes by their the cell, and you see their eyes full of tears hand one more folded envelope through those bars. And as the captive takes them and their hands touch for just a moment, takes it, opens it, see one last note, goodbye, a love letter saying farewell, with a few berries fall out of deadly nightshade. within them.
Ooh.
Mr. Kessler, Ms. Archer, please give me the rest of this scene. Ms. Archer, how do you keep Mad Dog under control, and what does it look like at the end?
I think she's just talking as much as possible, not really expecting him to understand her, but just, if for nothing, no other reason than to just kind of comfort herself, you know, so she's just kind of like remarking on that, oh, right, well, you see now that you meant wolf and not woof, which I suppose, anyway, so she's just kind of like, she's just kind of constantly talking, but I think at one point, if she can't find, like a fire poker or a piece of wood or something, she might just try to, like, punch him to knock him out.
Oh, that sounds dangerous.
Yes.
What's the end of this like for you, Mr. Kessler?
Well, depending on whether that punch works, I think immediately when he sees Archer there, he's going to try to attack her. So it's just, he probably like knocks over a cask of wine that breaks and spills out over the floor of the cellar.
I was going to drink that.
But he's just like at the end of the chain trying to bite at Archer. And he's going to howl, of course, when he's done transforming. I mean, there's moonlight streaking in through the cellar window, and he's going to have to let out a howl that they'll be able to hear upstairs, I'm sure. Especially the beagle.
Ms. Archer, you can knock out Mr. Kessler. You're a monster hunter by trade. Do you kill Mr. Kessler?
If he's knocked out, there's a moment where she's kind of like standing over him. She's got her hands on both of those knives, ready to like pull them out. But I think she wants more information first. She's going to see if he turns back. She's not going to unmanacle him, but she's just going to kind of pull a chair over and then just kind of like sit over him, just watching him until he can turn back.
Once he's knocked out, I like to think there's something human to the breathing, like just the way his chest is heaving. And, you know, he feels more human when he's knocked out.
I would like for both of you to mark an XP per the quickening move. And Ms. Archer, because you did not kill Mr. Kessler, I would like for you to mark an O on your hunt, please.
Oh.
And let's wrap up with Mr. Melmoth, Ms. Innocent, the possessed Ms. Thicket. I think this is going to be the night move. I love the idea of you playing a song on your flute. I assume you're going to mark your flute to get advantage on the roll.
Yes.
What are you afraid is going to happen if this does not work? Apart from Mr. Melmoth dying, as is already happening, yeah.
That she would come to me next.
Oh.
I think it's worse than that. I think it's worse than that. You will be possessed by the ghost. I think that's the trouble.
Yeah, that is worse for me.
Lot is riding on this roll. You can make it with regular... Well, it'd be 3d6 plus take the two highest for advantage, or, you know, roll advantage because of the flute, if you mark the flute.
Yeah.
And it's going to be with sensitivity.
Great. Let's see. 11 total.
Yay.
Yay.
The two of you can just together give me what the rest of the scene looks like. Mrs. Thicket will collapse and come out of her possession. The ghost will go away.
I bring the flute up to my lips and start to play this very, like, solemn but calming tune that's haunting, perhaps. I assume that we see Mrs. Thicket sort of freeze at first and become almost transfixed and almost possessed in a different way by the melody. And we see this spirit exit her? In some way.
Back out the window.
But it seems almost painful, like she is wrenched backwards and falls, you know, and hits the ground hard as it wisps out into the sky.
I'm curious, Mr. Melmoth, you have your faculties back. Mrs. Thicket is just standing there in a daze. You've had to listen to flute music. What do you do?
The flute music was distressing, but it wasn't the worst part of the experience. Sebastian just pulls himself away from the figure of Mrs. Thicket on the ground in absolute disgust. Almost recoils pushes himself up onto his feet and pulls a silk handkerchief from his pocket and wipes his lips and spits into it a number of times, just getting the taste of her out of his mouth. Moira can see that he is looking with absolute venomous, murderous intent at this woman on the ground.
Moira runs in front of her and sort of, like, sits on her. And puts her hands, you know, to kind of...
It's all right.
It is very far from all right, Miss Innes.
And then I just try to just slowly drag and escort her out of the room.
Out of the room, yeah.
Sebastian just looks at Mrs. Thicket as she's being led out and says... I'm sure we'll meet again. What was your name again?
She looks at you and she says, I don't remember anymore.
Oh, well, that won't matter. I'll just give her a big smile.
And that will conclude the night phase.
Good thing we got rid of all those villains.
Let's go to the dawn. Okay, so the dawn phase. We would collect rewards if a threat was resolved, but it was not yet. And so we'll instead go straight to dawn questions. Everybody has the same three questions to start. Did the hunters answer a capital Q question? You tried, but you did not yet. Did the hunters resolve a threat? Not yet. However, did you experience an echo in the night, Mr. Melmoth?
I believe I did with the echo of Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, that's a very good one. Yeah, I love that. So you can go ahead and get credit for that. Miss Archer, did you get an echo in the night?
Would you count the bound man being beaten as an echo?
Oh, yes, I'll take it. Yeah, because Mr. Kessler was bound, yeah. Ms. Innes, did you get an echo in the night?
The reading of the love letters.
the love letters. Yeah, I picked up on that. You get credit for that one. And finally, the American, where are you at? There you are. Did you get an echo in the night?
I was thinking maybe the pained howl echoing the moaning that Josephine described on the ship.
Oh, I'll take it. Yeah, I'll take it. That's good. Yeah, I'll take it.
He was shackled as well.
We'll stick with you, Mr. Kessler. Did you stick out in London society for all the wrong reasons? I would say at the Beals's you did, definitely.
This is an auto check every session, just so you know.
Did you use violence to solve a problem?
Not really. No, I don't think so.
Okay, so you picked up 2 XP or 3 XP, including your quickening XP for the session.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. Mr. Melmoth, did you let someone touch you and then make them pay a price for doing so?
I'd like to think that Mr. Etheridge qualified in that case.
Yeah, I think he probably did at some point touch you. Yeah, you did. You certainly didn't stop him from killing himself.
Yeah.
My God.
And also you kind of ruined him. Did you express a clear preference for the beautiful over the mundane?
No, that never really came up.
You get 2 XP. Ms. Archer, did you loudly curse your family's name?
I did not. Missed opportunity.
Did you tell someone why their plans were poorly made?
Oh, I didn't, even though there's opportunity for that too. Damn it. Look out, everybody.
You got 2 XP for the quickening as well as your echo in the night. And Moira Innes, did you delight in uncovering lost, forgotten, or ancient magic?
I think in the fortune teller, I definitely delighted.
I'll agree with that. Did you trust someone with sensitive information despite knowing the risks?
I mean, she seemed to already kind of know things about me. I don't know that that is me trusting her with it.
You actively trusting, yeah.
Although I did, like, kind of leave her a seashell and, like, a confirmation.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if we quite got there yet, but... so you got 2 XP. And let's keep going here. We resolve any moves if we needed to, but the quickening, we've already done that. I don't think we have any unresolved Janus Mask prompts at this point. Before we wrap up, just a quick little scene. Outside of London, out in the country, we see a large manor house It's nighttime, maybe even the same night as you're all being attacked at Hargrave House. We're in this grand library. Walls stacked high with books. Overstuffed leather furniture. And in one wall, an enormous map of the city takes up the entire wall. And sitting in front of the map is a wingback chair, though we can't see who's sitting in the chair. But we do see a very old butler, twisted over by age, carefully making his way to the chair, very, very slowly. He has a drink in a glass on a silver tray. He eventually makes his way to the chair. And we see the woman in the sapphire gown take the drink, give it a swallow. And she just sort of casually clicks her fingernails on that enormous blue jewel at her throat. She stands up and she walks over to the map and she takes out two large brass pins. She sticks one pin in the vicinity of 18 St. James's Street. She puts another pin directly on Hargrave House in Belgrave Square. And she smiles.